Hi there, and welcome to The Conscious Communicator, a show dedicated to helping you find your true voice, the nonviolent voice of personal responsibility and purpose, the voice that only you can speak. The reason that most of us fail to achieve our true voice is because of the false voices that occupy the mind. The voices of ego, consumption, expectation, opinion, and self-doubt rob us of our true nature, our true voice. Join me as we have a chat about inner purpose, outer passion, and finding your true voice. Welcome to The Conscious Communicator. My name is Rusty, and I'm here to host a chat about consciousness and communication. I appreciate your patience. This is my first time on the radio, so we're going to have some fun together. Conscious Communication is a show dedicated to helping people find their true voice. I really enjoyed listening to Dr. Brooks talk about all those interesting subjects that take place in places that I'm not familiar with. My world exists in the classrooms, day-to-day, teaching at schools and adult education classes, talking to people about violence, talking to them about finding their true voice, how they can find a way to express themselves in a world that will allow them to feel some sense of value and purpose. And I think that seems to be missing. I'm not really sure why. There seems to be a void out there, a void that a lot of people are experiencing. I see in the classrooms of our elementary schools, kids are coming to school angry. They're coming to school worried. They're coming to school afraid of what's happening at home. They're coming out of violent households. And they're having a hard time focusing and paying attention to what they're doing in school. These are the voices of the ego, the voices of consumption, expectation, opinion, self-doubt. And these voices rob us of our true nature, our true voice. I'm passionate about trying to help people find that voice, and I hope you'll join me tonight. So please call at any time. If you'd like to join in our conversation. Our topic questions tonight are kind of broad, but my question basically is, do you think people are getting angrier? And if so, why? What's up with our current state of politics? What's going on with reality television? And well, sometimes when I'm in the gym in the afternoon, I see the Maury Povich show and I think to myself, what? People are watching these kinds of situations as people argue about the paternity of a particular child or argue about whether or not someone cheated on somebody else, and ultimately my fear rests with the child themselves and worrying about that person. I'm wondering about the news that seems to minimize our lives into sound bites about negativity and fear. As a nation, we have more than any other civilization that's ever existed, and yet people seem to be lost and looking for something that's real, that will fill that gap that consumerism, consumption has failed to do. First, I want to thank everybody over at BBS Radio, especially Don and Leslie, who got me started. It's an interesting story, if you don't mind me sharing it with you. Leslie is a woman who I've known for a few years, and she had a tragedy that befell her several weeks ago. I never really talked to her other than just to say hello, but I took the time to talk to her on that particular occasion about what had happened, the loss of a friend. And after that encounter, she looked me right in the eye and she said, "You need to talk to my boss, Don." And I said, what do you guys do? And she said, "We do radio. I think you should have your own radio show." So I said, okay. And I gave Don a call. Talked to this guy on the phone. He's got a very deep baritone voice. And I was expecting to meet somebody in his 60s, kind of round, and, you know, someone who'd been in the business for years. And as it turned out, when he walked in, it was about a 5'10" fireball of energy, just about 160 pounds, motorcycle helmet, long brown hair, those blue eyes that you only see on dogs usually. You know, you have those bright blue eyes, and just intense, with a wonderful sense of compassion. He was very apologetic because we had missed a meeting prior to that, and he just wanted to talk to me about what he was doing at BBS Radio. And it was apparent to me from the very beginning that this is a person who was passionate, and his passion was about finding the truth. He didn't have any preconceived idea of what that truth might be, but he was interested in providing a venue where people could search for the truth. And I'm sure those of you that are avid listeners are aware of the fact that this station has more than its share of opportunities for people from all different realms to search for truth. So I sat down and talked for Don for about an hour, and we talked about some of the stuff that I was interested in. And he said, "Yeah, I think it's a great idea. I think you should give it a shot." We spent several weeks going back and forth about a name, and we came up with a Conscious Communicator. And please don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to act as if I am that. I think my Conscious Communicator is kind of like Nietzsche's Übermensch or Overman. It's an expectation of something to come, an evolution in consciousness. And we're interested in trying to provide a venue once a week on Sundays to talk about that kind of stuff. Don and I met. It was obvious to me that he cared very much about what he was doing, and I wanted to join the team. So we got started, and here we are today. A little bit about how I got here. I'm actually raised a military brat. Grew up in the Air Force, traveling around the world. Moved about every 2 years with my family of seven. It was 5 kids, 4 boys and a girl. My poor sister was the middle child and the only girl, but she's tougher than all the rest of us and probably smarter and more successful than the rest of us as well. But having to move all that time taught me a lot about a bunch of different things, including people. And I learned very quickly to begin to cue into people and begin to read them, find out what they were all about. And at some level, it seemed like I had an ability to help them. It seemed like I was able to help them to solve problems. It was very easy for me to listen and to pay attention to what was going on specifically with them and give them some ideas about what I thought might be some ways for them to approach these issues. Later on in life, I became a bartender, and actually was a bartender, still am to this day, doing bartending in different areas, and I have my own business doing weddings and parties. But what I found interesting about bartending, again, was the people and talking to them about their situations. And what I found was that most people were looking for something. Most people were trying to find a way not only to make money and be successful, but a way to express themselves in the world. And for some reason, they seemed attracted to me and like to talk to me about those ideas and those dreams, and I appreciated that. As I moved on through my life, I was able to then go back to school, get my master's in counseling, and started working in the schools as a counselor, and found myself teaching in classrooms. And the program that I ended up teaching most was the anti-violence program, which is called Second Step. We go into the classrooms and teach the kids these little skills that they could use to help them to accomplish what they were trying to do, whether it be get the ball in the playground or talk to somebody that was bothering them or deal with a bully. And as I did that, I realized that these were issues that were real to me. These were issues that I had dealt with all my life. I think anger management and frustration has been part of who I've been from the very beginning, and it's something that I've struggled with, so it became something I was very passionate about teaching, because I think we teach best that which we need to learn. So I continued on in that path and by accident ran into a guy who was running domestic violence classes for people out of on parole or probation. These are men and women who had found themselves into the judicial system. and they are mandated in the state of California to a 52-week program, 2 hours a week for 52 weeks, talking about power and control and gender roles, issues around the cycle of violence. And as I've done that over the last 3 years, it's been one of the most powerful transformations in my own life, as I've taken these tools and tried to use them to teach myself how to communicate more effectively with other people. I'm now currently a counselor, anger management counselor. I still do the domestic violence classes. I also still teach in the schools. I have a website every day that goes out to elementary school kids called School Tools. It's a 1-minute webcast that talks about some of these things on a daily basis. For those of you that are a little older, you might remember when we were kids, Saturday morning cartoons, they had things like Conjunction Junction, What's Your Function, and a bill on Capitol Hill. And they'd show those things in between our cartoons. And they were little, like, 1-minute commercials of value that helped us to pay attention to some of the stuff we might have been learning in school. So I created School Tools in the same mode. It's basically a daily 1-minute webcast where the kids watch this stuff, and every day it gives them an idea about what the expectations are for us and some concrete tools that they can use to help themselves to do better in the world. And that's the same thing I'm hoping to provide here. I hope that in an hour a week we can have some conversations about communication, some of the things that are bothering you, some of the things that might be difficult, your opinions about the state of communication. Is communication evolving? Are we starting to see an evolution in consciousness? Eckhart Tolle, in his new book, The New Earth, talks a lot about an evolution in consciousness and thinks that this period of time is just possibly the kind of like the loud music before the final curtain, and we're going to evolve into a more conscious creature. I happen to believe that consciousness is really the next evolutionary stage for what we're going through. I mean, the human being, we seem to be getting a little faster, a little stronger. Obviously, watching Michael Phelps in the Olympics, we're probably swimming better than we did 20 years ago. But it's not changing that dramatically, but hopefully consciousness is changing. I heard Dr. Brooks talking about that earlier, about the level. He talked about we're here now, and we're communicating at such an extreme level, and that there are people out there that are aware and conscious. And those of you that are listening, I invite you to join the show. Talk to us about your experiences in this area. Also, some of the challenges you might be facing in communication. Because we've been told that more is better. We've been told that money solves our problems, and yet in this country, that doesn't seem to be the case. I know my experience when I was in San Francisco in the 90s, experiencing the internet boom, I had more money than I ever thought I would, but it didn't seem to provide that feeling, that sense of purpose. I get more purpose out of doing something random like this, or out of talking to a room full of kids or a classroom full of guys on parole or probation than I ever did making money. I remember one time getting a check for $5,000 selling Frisbees to a internet company that was going to a job fair. And I sat there and looked at that check, and somebody asked me, how do you feel? And I didn't feel anything. I mean, obviously, it wasn't feeding some deeper level that I needed. It took care of my basic needs, but it didn't feed me at a deeper level. I think we're looking outside of ourselves for validation and security. You know, money is the key to that. So many people are chasing after security. We're trying to figure out whether or not we have something that we can hold on to. Kind of reminds me of the seagulls and the Little Mermaid. I love those when they run around going, mine, 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 mine. And that kind of reminds me of the people that I see running around all the time. They're just chasing after mine, you know, that fragile, egoic self that is something that we didn't come into this world with, and we certainly aren't going to be able to take it with us, but we focus on that as if there's some security in that, as if in some way that's going to provide us with the happiness that we're looking for. Now, I'm not against money. I think money's great. Money provides opportunities, provides choices, provides a chance for you to do things. The reason I was able to go back to school when I was in my mid to late 30s was because of money. You know, I was able to sell a house in San Francisco before everything changed, and I had some money in the bank, so I was able to take that and turn it into a new challenge, a new opportunity for me. So money's wonderful, but it's just a tool like everything else. And what we want to offer to you here are tools as well, tools for communication, tools for discovering more about yourself and finding out something that you might be looking for, and to talk to you about what's on your mind. We look to the outside, we look outside this world for answers and truth. I hear that all the time. Modern religions are constantly talking about the next world. I was raised in an environment that believed that this world was at some level flawed and that we needed to transcend this world in order to go forward. And there are a lot of people on this station as well that talk about that kind of transcendence. But I think of myself as more of a cognitive, kind of a therapist, cognitive, rational, kind of the here and now, and dealing with the reality of what we have here. Because I'm not too sure that I'll be able to see the value of what comes next if I don't see the value of what I'm looking at right now. Is it just me, or does there seem to be a void getting bigger, the void between true self and experience? A lot of times we're out there chasing experiences. I work with a lot of young kids in foster care, and it's so fascinating to work with teenagers who are locked in the emotional amygdala part of the brain, the middle part of the brain. A lot of times parents will come to me complaining that their kids always seem to need constant excitement and constant things to do, and I think that's partly because of the fact that they're going through that brain evolution period where they're in the amygdala, and the amygdala talks about experience and wanting more and wanting now. It's based in feeling and the immediate need for feeling. And oftentimes I think some of us get stuck there. A lot of us get stuck in wanting more. I think a lot of the drug and alcohol addiction that we see, I work a lot with people who are dealing with those kinds of issues. Two things are interesting. One, enough never seems to be enough, and they keep craving what's next, and that can be true of anything, including food or money, power, fame, success. Power. People are always talking about power, like the man. You know, the man's got all the power. I think I listened to Dr. Brooks talking about the expansion of the universe, and it just kind of cracks me up. I mean, who are these people that think that they have power when they look up in the stars at night and they realize what a huge amount of space is out there and how small we really are? But, man, there are people out there chasing it. They're looking for it as if it's some way, shape, or form is going to make them more happy. I don't know about you, but I've experienced happiness and contentment. And I know that there's, when you've experienced happiness and contentment, there's nothing more that you could possibly want. I mean, you can't buy more of it. When you're happy and content, you're happy and content. I mean, what else could you buy? What else could you want? Last Friday, I was down in San Francisco at a place called Stinson Beach, and I was body surfing with my nephews, Riley, Charlie, and Mike. They're 12, 10, and 8. My brother Mike and I were down there, and the waves were just incredible. I don't know how tall they were. I like to think they were 10 feet, but I don't understand how all that stuff works. But I spent the better part of an hour just trying to throw my youngest nephew, Mike, over the waves because it was so hard for us to swim out because the surf was so big. And At some point, I started to feel a little frustrated, like I wanted to ride the waves myself or I wanted to be out there experiencing more. And the reality was is that in that moment, in that particular moment, I was doing something that made me completely happy and completely content. And there wasn't any more. There wasn't anything else that I could have wanted. Helping that young man to get out there and catch his waves is one of the reasons that I think I got into counseling and got on a radio show myself, because I want to help people catch their wave. I want to help them to ride their crest and to stay present in the moment. And I think about riding waves as being like being present in the moment. Riding that one wave, riding the crest. If you're too early, you get crushed. If you're too late, you miss it. But once you catch a wave and you ride it, that's like riding the timeline. It's like being fully present, fully aware of what's going on. And that's amazing. Again, I refer to Eckhart Tolle. If you haven't checked out his book, The New Earth is the one that I listen to. I don't read. I like to listen to books on tape. But it's fascinating when he talks about the idea of being present. And I heard Dr. Brooks say that he said something about consciousness, and most people wouldn't know consciousness. He said that it would be a paperweight in their room. But I think that that's true. We see so many people that are walking around. Sometimes I walk my dog, Jake, who's sitting here with me right now. We turn this into a webcast one of these days. I'll have a computer so you can see us on TV. But Jake and I walk every day. It's part of my it's part of my health process, but it's also part of my mental health process. And we get out there, and sometimes I'm into it. You know, I'm walking, I'm paying attention to him. I'm walking at his pace and following him and letting that happen. But most of the time, I'm just trudging on, just thinking about all these things I'm supposed to be doing. What am I supposed to be doing now? You know, what should I have done yesterday? And that's that mind, that's that negative voice in your head. It's that voice that constantly is just focused and constantly telling us things. And that voice is so life-denying. You know, I used to think it was, you know, it's like, man, I'm a thinker. You know, constantly got thoughts going on inside of my head. I don't know about you, but when I wake up in the morning, my thoughts are not like conscious creations. They're these rote tapes, these ongoing tapes that go over and over in my head. Usually when my normal day when I wake up, first thing I think is, you know, what did I do last night? Or, you know, what did I do? What should I be doing today? And then usually I'll get a song stuck in my head. That's what seems to be happening to me lately. There's a song stuck in my head. And I'm sitting there with this song stuck in my head, and I'm asking myself these questions, and I'm saying, should I have done this different? What if I had done that different? Or what if I had said something different to this client? Or how should I have handled that different? And those aren't thoughts. Those are just like tapes. Tapes from the past, from somebody else. Most of the time, it's this critical voice that I hear in my head, and it's not conscious creation. It's not thought. It's just tapes. It's kind of like noise. It's kind of like static in the brain, background noise. And what Tolle talks about is the idea of being aware of the noise, but not allowing the noise to be who I am. And as I practice that on a daily basis, usually when I'm walking Jake around, the most interesting thing to me is the things that I pick up, the different things that I begin to notice, the creativity that exists in present moment awareness. The show, for example, one of the things Don told me, don't script it. And I've tried not to. I wrote down some notes, don't get me wrong. But I've tried not to. I try to be present. I'd love to get a phone call because I'd love to feed off of the energy of the audience. Talk to you about what's interesting to you. Be creative in the moment. So many of us think that that's not the way to do it. We live in the past or we live in the future. We're constantly analyzing what we could have done or should have done. We're thinking about what we should be doing. One of my favorite quotes is, don't should all over yourself. But we do that constantly. We're planning for things that haven't come yet. We're thinking about things that are already past. We're existing in time that, in truth, is not really time that we have access to. Past or future or time periods that it currently we don't really have that much access to. Now, again, there's stations on this radio station that talk about that kind of stuff, but my focus is on the here and now, the rational and the real, what we can do in this moment, what we can do in this moment together to help each one of us to become a better person. Dr. Brooks' ending, when he talks about helping people by experiencing yourself and being open to other possibilities. I hope that you'll join me on the show. Talk a little bit about what you're experiencing and your ideas in this regard. The other thing that I've been thinking about lately is the political dialogue and why it's so negative and why we let it continue. You know, for years we've been complaining about politics, their ratings are historically as low as anything you could possibly imagine. And yet we continue to let it go on and we continue to let that happen and the dialogue has become so negative. We have so many people out there that are working for a living instead of finding something of value that they can do without effort or struggle. You know, to me, being a counselor isn't something that I think about doing. I don't wake up in the morning and go, I got to prepare to be a counselor, or I need to do my homework. It's part of who I am. It's part of my daily routine. It's the kind of stuff that I enjoy doing. The dialogue and the interaction with clients, the reading and the information that I amass online and in other areas are things that are interesting to me. And for a long time, I thought that wasn't going to be enough. You know, I chased money. I chased after material instead of trying to do what came naturally to me, which is be a teacher, a coach, a counselor. It's funny because my mom, who passed away 3 years ago, Sandy Brown, she had kept a folder for all of us kids. And inside of that folder was all of our report cards and letters that we had written. I mean, she'd saved everything. And I went through it. I got it maybe 6 months ago, and flying back from the East Coast, my sister had given it to me. I opened that thing up on the plane. And one of the first things I ran into was a term paper I'd written for a speech class in 1984 at Angelo State University in Texas. And it was asking us where we saw ourselves in 10 years, which is a great question for a 21-year-old or whatever. And it was funny because I read that thing, and it talked about being a teacher, being a coach, being a counselor, doing all the things that I'm doing today. But in that 20 years in between, I got caught up chasing other people's dreams, other people's ideas of success, other people's idea of what Rusty was supposed to be all about. I lost myself. I knew who I was at 21, but somewhere along the line, I lost that. And we see that so much these days. So frustrating when you look at higher education. You've got students that are going to school spending tens of thousands of dollars a year, and they graduate. The current statistic is like less than 60% of students get a job in the area that they got their degree in, but they come out with 40 or 50 or sometimes even more, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of debt. What are they going to do? Well, they're going to do what everybody else does. They're going to take the highest paying job doing whatever it happens to be. They're going to continue to work. They're going to do what we're told to do, which is buy more stuff, because the more stuff you have, the more successful you are. And as we continue to chase that stuff, we're going to put ourselves in more debt, or we're going to put ourselves in a situation where we've got to make that $30,000, $40,000, $60,000, $100,000 a year. So we're basically like a gerbil on a wheel. We never have an opportunity to get off. We never have an opportunity to take a break, to think about what we really might have to offer, what our true voice might really be. Why are so many people depressed, anxious, afraid? You know, ever since 9/11, it seems like fear has been the number one motivator. But we see it in advertising. We see it on television constantly, in the news. We talk all the time about how people seem to be struggling with fear, anxiety, and depression. There was a study in New York. They were offering everybody in New York City a depression questionnaire. And if they answered the questionnaire in a certain way, they could get on the depression medication. And we're talking about millions and millions of people in New York City, which can be depressing at some level, although I think it's very vibrant. I love being in big cities. But millions and millions of people on depression medication. Why? Why are so many people depressed? What's going on, excuse me, that's causing them to feel that level of depression and anxiety, that level of fear? Well, basically, I think it's because we're living from that egoic self, the egoic self which is fragile by nature because it doesn't really exist anywhere other than in this plane. You think about Alzheimer's, for example. It's fascinating to me when an Alzheimer's patient can lose every piece of their personality during the process of that debilitating disease. And the question then becomes, so then what is it that goes to the next level? If it's not your memories and your thoughts and the words and your experiences and that egoic self of who I am, how we define ourselves in this plane of existence, what goes on to the next level? Traditionally, it's been called soul or Atman. What is it that goes to the next level? What goes on? Well, there must be some sense of that awareness, the awareness that experienced those things, but it's not the things that define us. It's not being a counselor that defines me. It's not being a radio show host or a son. It's not being a white male in America in 2008. It's the awareness that is aware of those things that are a part of my existence. The awareness is what's key. The awareness that's untouched by these other things. The fear and the depression and the anxiety can only affect the egoic self because that's fragile by nature. It's fragile because it's not real. We think about people who have to go through traumatic illness or suffer from a fall and lose the ability to use their bodies. They have to redefine who they are completely, and that can be an incredible challenge because so much of who they are is defined in that ego. I was an athlete. I was a construction worker. I was this. I was that. I was a great dancer. We look at the athletes and how they struggle. the whole thing with Brett Favre, if any of you are sports fans, call me about sports. I'll talk about that, too. But Brett Favre and this whole thing about apparently his unbelievable need for attention, you know, and I worry about him. He's had some struggles in the past with some other issues, but I worry about his ability to leave the game at some point because so much of who he is or who he thinks he is defined by that person, by that quarterback, by the individual that wears the pads, not the awareness of the person who wears the pads, but the actual person itself. And a lot of athletes we've seen that happen to. They're not able to leave gracefully because they've defined themselves that way. Moving on and making change is very, very hard. And for a lot of us, we don't do it very gracefully. The brain doesn't like change, doesn't accept it very well. A lot of my work lately has been talking about the brain and the different parts of the brain, but one of the things that we realize is that the brain is basically a layering, categorizing system. It takes in information and it makes decisions about whether or not it's safe or dangerous. And over time, those categories build up. And they build up, and so then when new information comes in, it's judged against the old information. And I think it's interesting. I think it's a Buddhist saying talking about cleaning the window, a dirty window, the ability to clean off those layers and layers of existence and experience so that we can look at each event as if it was brand new, the way a child looks at those events. They look at them and they see it for the first time. And it's not good or bad or anything. They just see it for what it is. And as we get older, our windows get dirty. They get filled up with different kinds of layers of pain and suffering, fear and anxiety. We begin to stereotype people in different ways. We begin to judge people based on what we see. And we lose the possibility of learning new things. We lose the possibility of experiencing new things because we have these ideas. This is right. This is the way it is. This is who I am. We get into the role of black and white thinking. These are some of the things that we're going to be talking about in the weeks to come. Some of the things that stop conscious communication. Black and white thinking. Catastrophizing. My brother calls it boil the ocean. Catastrophizing everything. You know, something happens, you're like, it's the worst thing that could have ever happened, or I'm going to lose my job. Conscious communication takes each situation independently and tries to look at it. Even though we judge it against past experience and we think about it, we're not stuck to that past experience. We're not completely locked into it. We're able to look at it and think about it and give it its own new light. Obviously, as I said before, that is a goal that we're trying to achieve. But we're going to talk about some of these things as we give you concrete tools that you can use in your daily life that will help you. So much of what we're dealing with right now is that sense of unconsciousness, a belief that we're actually, because we're looking and we're talking and we're awake, that we're actually consciously aware of the processes that are going on in our decision making and the way that we look at situations and people. Are we really giving people an opportunity and situations an opportunity, or is the past holding us back? We're going to talk a lot about personal gravity or mental gravity, things that happened to us in the past that seem to hold us back. We're going to talk about ideas about how to change those tapes, how to rewind that, how to get in touch with that voice and to become aware of just how it can affect you, and it can affect you in a positive way as well. But it's like a wild horse. It's beautiful and powerful and strange and everything else, but if it's not tamed, it's not going to be much good to you or I. So we have to learn how to do that. The conscious communicator is somebody who is aware of those thoughts on an ongoing basis, aware of who they are, making some conscious changes to try and become aware of that voice that might be holding them back, and being open to the fear, and being okay with the fact that you're afraid. Just before I started the show tonight, I was afraid walking into this kind of an opportunity, and I may just be talking to myself in cyberspace, but still the idea that other people might be out there judging those kinds of things obviously is going to bring anxiety to some people, including myself. But it's not something that can hold you back. And you face that fear and go into it and try to make something out of it. We oftentimes confuse thoughts with consciousness. I think, you know, when Kant said, I think, therefore I am, I think for a lot of us we believe that that kind of thought, that rote, daily, repetitive thought was what we were interested in. But the reality of that is most of us aren't really aware of the fact that there's a deeper level, a more conscious level that we have access to. I'm going to take a break real quick, and hopefully Don will give us a little music while we take a break and grab a drink of water. I hope you'll join us. If you have any questions, please call in. If not, I'll be back in just 1 minute to talk to you a little bit more about the conscious communicator.
I think Peter Matheson said it best when he said, "Soon a child's clear eyes are clouded over by ideas, opinions, perceptions, and impressions. Simple free being becomes encrusted with the burdensome armor of ego. Not until years later does an instinct come that a vital sense of mystery has been lost. The sun glints through the pines and the heart is pierced in a moment of beauty and strange pain, like a memory of paradise. After that, we become seekers. Join me, seekers. The rest is..."
Communicator. Again, our topic question for today is, do you think people are getting angrier? And if so, why? What is causing people to be so angry or frustrated? Call in at any time. We'd love to talk to you about your thoughts or anything else that might be on your mind regarding conscious communication. We define conscious communication as that kind of communication that's nonviolent. The communication that's the personal voice of responsibility and purpose, the voice that only you can speak. One of the things when I think about conscious communication or the lack thereof, I had an experience the other day. I was going to Toys R Us to pick up a toy for my nephew Charlie. It's Naruto or some sort of video game that he wants. And I was at what I thought was a three-way stop. And there was two people stopped at the stop signs and I had stopped as well. But apparently I didn't have a stop sign. And so the person on my right, at some point, once I became aware of the fact that I was supposed to keep on going, I think he honked or something, I looked across at this guy driving a Suburban. It kind of looks like a train car. You know, I mean, these things are gigantic. I know the new Suburbans are unbelievably large. But he's yelling. He's got his windows up, but obviously his face is completely distorted. He's yelling at me, lines, everything. He's screaming. You can see the cuss words are flying out of his mouth. And I looked past him, and behind him in the back seat are two car seats, and these, you know, 3-year-old, 2-year-old, 4-year-old, something like that, two kids sitting back there, and they're not looking at me. They're looking straight at their dad. And I'm just sitting there thinking to myself, man, what is going on? What is causing that level of interaction? Obviously, I was not doing what I was supposed to be doing, but where did that come from? Probably just came from the fact that he just had to fill up that big, gigantic tank he was driving. But, I mean, it can't just be that, you know? It can't just be that he's that frustrated because I'm a bad driver. You know, and road rage is a perfect example of unconscious communication and how we tell ourselves that the world is happening to us. We take it so personally, as if in some way, shape, or form that I actually waited for him to get to that stop sign so that I could slow down his progress. You know, that I could actually do that. Somebody cuts us off in traffic, we think they did it on purpose. A train comes when we're late to work, we think it happened to us on purpose. And we're sitting there saying to ourselves constantly, how can this happen to me? This isn't fair. What's funny to me about road rage and adult rage and some of these other things, it sounds very much like children on elementary school playgrounds. You know, we hear kids talking about that all the time. That's the number one red flag when I'm on a playground. I hear a kid yell, that's not fair! We go running in that direction because there's going to be a fight. Kids have this overactive sense of fairness. And they start yelling, that's not fair, that's my ball, I brought it from my classroom, give it back to me now. And they start fighting with each other. You know, some girl said something to another girl, and they said, oh, no, she didn't, I'm going to get her for that, no, she didn't. And they get all up and going after each other, and their words, you know, one girl will call another and say, her hair looks funny, or, you know, she doesn't like her dress. And the reaction is anger. And the reaction almost constantly that we see in these situations is people just getting very angry, like they're defending themselves. They're defending themselves against the perception that other people might not like what they have to wear, what they're wearing. They might not like what they have to say. We're constantly defending ourselves. We're worried about whether or not people are going to like us, and I fall into that category myself. It's amazing. I talk about my dog Jake all the time. Jake and I can be walking in the middle of the woods, me and him, all by ourselves. There is no way that Jake can do anything that's going to make me angry in that situation. On the other hand, if Jake does something in front of other people when I'm walking him that caused me to feel some sense of embarrassment or caused me to feel some sense of embarrassment, that's not conscious communication. When I internalize it as embarrassment, then I get angry at my dog. But I'm not really angry at my dog. I'm angry because I think those people might not think of me as a good dog owner. Half the time when I see parents upset at their kids, they're upset at their kids for a variety of reasons, but a lot of times it's because their kid embarrassed them in front of other people. And it's other people's opinions. It's other people that we're focused on. This guy in the road rage situation, he's focused on me, as if in some way, shape, or form, I planned it, or I should know how to drive better, or I should realize that it was a two-way stop instead of a three-way stop. And he wants me to believe, he wants me to know, for in no uncertain terms, that he's right and I'm wrong. Well, good, you know what? You're right, I'm wrong, I should have kept going. But why? Why do you get that angry? And then again, think about the kids. The kids are sitting behind him watching what he's doing, and what's he teaching them? He's teaching them to overreact to the simplest situation. Something that had absolutely no major value whatsoever. Anger? Great emotion. Wonderful. Changes the world. I hope you're angry about child abuse, domestic violence, unconscious communication, a lot of the stuff that we're going to talk about on this show. I hope you're angry about that stuff, and I hope that anger drives you to call the show, join in, join a group, start a third party in politics, do whatever that anger leads you to do. It's the expression of anger, the external expression of anger towards other people, you know, using force to try and hurt someone else. I heard something the other day, knowledge of others is wisdom, knowledge of yourself is enlightenment. Controlling others requires force, controlling yourself requires strength. And I thought about that. Controlling other people requires force. And if we're going to use force to control other people, ultimately it's not going to work. We're seeing that in the Middle East right now. As much as the war may have been beneficial or not beneficial, and I'm sure historians will have a field day deciding whether or not it was or wasn't, ultimately it's going to come down to communication. It's going to come down to people talking. It's going to come down to people negotiating. It's going to come down to people solving problems. Now, for the hawks of you out there that are angry about that, we think about it in terms of even the biological reality of things like antibiotics. Now, one of the biggest fears that we have right now is that antibiotics are creating a super virus. Because anything that you fight against, you make it stronger. And we may knock Al-Qaeda down. We may destroy them. We may totally knock them out. Does that mean that there's not going to be that kind of dissent in the Middle East and the young people of the Middle East, that that's just going to go away, that we're going to wipe it off the face of the map. If violence had worked, why wouldn't there have already been a winner? Because the weapons keep getting bigger? But don't you think if violence had worked, there would already be a winner at some point? I mean, we've been doing it for, what, 6,000 years as far as we know? All the way back to the cave people? And now we've got this new conscious mind, and we're supposed to be using it, but we're still acting as if it's a life-or-death situation. I'm telling kids that all the time on the playground. Is it really worth punching Johnny in the neck because he took your soccer ball? Well, he was disrespecting me. What does that mean? He took your soccer ball. Why are we reacting with this level of anger, frustration? Where is it coming from? Am I the only one? Am I the only one that is experiencing it? I don't think so. And then we start talking about the statistics out there in the field that I work in. I was looking up on some of the statistics online to get the facts about domestic violence and some of the things that are going on out there. They talk about nearly 25% of women and almost 8% of men have been physically assaulted by a current or former spouse. Approximately 1.3 million women and 835,000 men are physically assaulted by an intimate partner annually in the United States. Intimate partner violence makes up 20% of all non-fatal violent crime experienced by women. And all this stuff usually happens in the presence of children. What's going on? Why are people angry? Well, in my mind, it's because that egoic self, that sense of who they are, is not being dealt with. They're not getting the answers that they want. We had some emails that came in talking about, do you think people are getting angrier? And some that came in, the first one comes in from MS Dank. There's pressure all around. Pressure to have the best job, the best looks. Pressure is to be something you're really not. Even the kids these days receive too much pressure. I mean, damn, my 7-year-old had homework every night. To me, it's just absurd. Let kids be kids, damn it. No recess at school anymore. Oh, wait, that's because they have physical education 5 days a week now. Like, that can actually make up for the fun time a kid has in the schoolyard and the playground. Pressure from the other kids who have the coolest clothes, although mine has been the best dressed every year since pre-K, ha-ha. Pressure to not be able to spend our money on things that truly make us happy because you're spending too much money on gas and groceries. The world is getting angrier. Where's the fun? Where's the relaxation? It's all work, work, work. Come home, cook, clean, homework, errands, the time to just sit and relax and enjoy. What makes you feel good? The pressure is coming from another source. Oh, here it is again, the man. The man cares more about money in his pocket as if there's not enough of it there as of now. And again, I don't understand that. I don't understand who this man is that needs more money in their pocket. Obviously, there's probably people out there who experience that. But if you're a couple, and I'm assuming that this person is a couple with children, and you're working two jobs to buy the best clothes for your kids best dressed, and you have to drive the latest car, and you have to live in that particular neighborhood, and you have to go to those particular schools, isn't it you? I mean, we can point the finger outside of ourselves and ask ourselves the question, who is it that's drawing us down? But isn't it you, ultimately? Aren't you putting that pressure on yourself to live up to some preconceived expectation of other people? You know, I was fortunate. I was raised by a father that gave each one of us enough money to buy 2 pair of blue jeans, a new pair of tennis shoes, less than $25, and a couple of school shirts. For a long time, we went to private school, so we had the uniforms. We didn't have to worry about it. But my father had no problem saying no. And I think as I've gotten older, I've really appreciated that because, you know, I'm a pretty simple person. You know, I'm moving back to San Francisco to be closer to those nephews I told you about. A lot of people ask me, how can you afford to live in the city, man? It's so expensive. It's not expensive if you don't spend money on a bunch of things you don't need. If you don't eat in a bunch of restaurants that you don't need to eat in. If you don't try and buy the designer clothes. I'm fortunate my brother down there, his wife is a fantastic shopper for him, and when he gets rid of his clothes, he gives them all to me. So I'm fortunate in that regard, and then I try and pass it on down and give my clothes to somebody else. But I don't need that stuff. Now, again, I'm single. I don't have kids. There's a lot of people in that situation. But again, you chose that situation. Looking outside of yourself for answers, I think, is a no-win situation because ultimately the man, whoever that is outside of your control. Apparently, this person is running everything, and we're not capable of getting in touch with that person. And just like I talk to my guys in the domestic violence classes, and I talk to people about this all the time, it's not going to do us any good to look outside of ourselves. Well, she did this, or she did that, or she's a this, or she's a this. What good does that do? It's not going to help you in terms of solving the problem. The problem ultimately is coming from inside of yourself. The problem ultimately is coming from inside of you. And that's the only place we can start. That's where conscious communication starts. Maybe the man exists. Maybe there's something real out there. But the chances are that you and I, individually, we're not going to find that until we spend the time to find ourselves, to find a way for us to express ourselves, to bring that thing to reality. We have another email from Mr. V. Seeing and experiencing the anger of people is just seeing the superficial expression. There will be a lot of hidden emotions which make them angry. No one loves to be angry unless they're forced or irritated to. It's not just a human being. It's true of any animal. Even the wildest animal turns fierce when it wants to get something or is being haunted by some fear. It could have been caused by you or an external force. Well, I would agree that if you're haunted by something or haunted by a fear or you want to get something, the wildest animal will turn fierce. But again, that goes back to the idea of the consumption model. If you're constantly chasing your tail, you're constantly chasing after things, if there's some fear that you're being haunted by, let's look at the things that we're chasing. Let's make sure that those are the things that we actually need. Let's make sure that we are aware of what it is that we are spending our time following and chasing after. And then if there are fears that we're being haunted by, fine. Let's discuss them. Join the show, Mr. V. Let's talk about those fears. I personally feel people are more helpless these days. They know that most of the things going on around them are wrong, yet can't do anything, and hence helplessness builds frustration, which is expressed as anger. I don't disagree with the fact that there's more frustration. I will agree 100%. People are frustrated, and frustration can lead to anger. But the truth is that what we should be focusing on, I use the word should, you should call me on that anytime, owe you a dime. When you work on the idea of the frustration and use that energy in a way to do something productive, maybe you can't change the political environment at a national level, but you can get involved locally. I got into a conversation the other night. I was at a wine, we were bottling wine at a friend of mine's house. And these two people were coming at me with these stories of the man, the man building prisons, doing these things, everything that was going on. And I was really interested in what they had to say. But my first question for them is, do you vote? And they said no. I said, are you involved in politics at any level? And they said no. I said, well, do you get involved in rallies? Do you write emails? Do you get involved in blogs? Do you do? No, we don't. And so I don't really understand what that means other than the fact that, yeah, they're upset and frustrated about the state of affairs, but can you do something to work on that? Can you do something to bring some change into the world? What can you do? What can you bring? What do you have to offer? I talked about myself being a counselor, a teacher, a coach. What is it that you have? You know, a lot of times people volunteer outside of their own family. They go outside and they spend time volunteering and they do stuff like that to the expense of their actual family. You know, Don said something to me when he first met him. He talked about presence, being completely present when he's with his wife and his children. Presence. Whatever you do with present awareness, you do it in a way that's going to be beneficial. But a lot of times we're looking externally. We're running around trying to find some volunteer activity or something else that we can do. But why are we chasing after those things when we have these things right in front of us? Things that we could be working on. So yes, Mr. V, I agree people are frustrated and they might feel helpless, but the point is to deal with that. Deal with the feeling. Do something to help you not feel so helpless. Come on BBC or BBS Radio and get your own radio show for an hour every week and talk about that frustration. Find other people who have a like voice to yours and have them join you and begin to build an opportunity where people can get together and discuss these frustrations. Do something. Get involved. Another email comes from Ed T. I feel Americans seem not to handle pressure well. People seem to be more angry due to the economic slowdown, the increased crime rate, the inadequate service contractors or retail stores. Don't know exactly what that is, Mr. Ed, but I think it's probably, Mr. Ed, but I think it probably has something to do with the quality of service. Folks hate taxes or harsh weather, which hurts their homes. If you combine all these and more, you will discover why those of weak faith become angry and take it out on others. Example, road rage, divorce, and other small issues made large. Is there an answer? Yes. But he doesn't go on to say what that answer is. I'm assuming that Mr. Ed, it says people of faith, maybe Mr. Ed has a faith that helps him with these issues, which I think for a long time traditionally faith was something that helped people with these issues. But oftentimes what I see in my work is that a lot of people will end up trying not to get angry, but they just end up stuffing these issues. They stuff these feelings inside of them. And instead of feeling better, just over time, it shows up in other areas of their life. I think overeating has a lot to do with that. We see a lot of people that eat, they're emotional eaters. They feel like they don't want to have conflict in their life. I was reading a book recently that talked about the growing divorce rate or challenge rate of couples after 10, 12 years of marriage. And these are couples who don't have any, apparently, external problems. There's successful, quote-unquote, successful families that have money and live in nice places and they care about each other and there's no infidelity or drug or alcohol issues or anything like that. And so they were asking these people, and what apparently seems to be the problem is that the couples at some point during the relationship made a conscious or unconscious decision to no longer have any conflict in the relationship. They just decided that it was beneath them to have any kind of critical discussion about the relationship. I imagine that the thought process was that it was just going to be, you know, we're just going to deal with each other, accept each other's situation, and move on. But what apparently happens when that decision is made is that the couples began to move apart. The passion and the love that brought them together in the first place was starting to dissipate because there wasn't that ongoing intellectual conversation about their relationship, about each other, and that seemed to have a negative effect on these people and their relationships. Their relationships were falling apart, not because they were fighting, for the very opposite reason, because they weren't having dialogue. They weren't talking about issues and problems. And that's really what we want to do here on the Conscious Communicator. We want to get together every week and talk about communication, finding that nonviolent voice of personal responsibility and purpose, the voice that only we can speak. It's really been a pleasure talking to you today. I hope that those of you that are out there have had an opportunity to kind of get to know me and will think seriously about joining us next week. Probably think about bringing on a guest next week so you can get something other than my voice. Don's helping me out with trying to find people and bring on some interesting guests so we can have a dialogue. I saw one of the emails that I got from a poet. Can't imagine any more conscious communication than poetry. And bringing somebody on that can talk to us a little bit about their experience. And the people that I want to bring on are people that, like I told you about Don, somebody who's incredibly passionate about this radio station. I hope you notice it in me. And in my voice, I'm incredibly passionate about this subject. I want to bring you passionate people, people who are interested in these topics and these issues who can talk to us about that. And I really hope that you'll bring your questions to us as well, because I would love to interact with you on a regular basis. I think this show would be a lot more interesting for everybody if we could get you involved and bring you on. And as you heard in the break, I think Peter Matheson said it best. Soon a child's clear eyes are clouded by ideas, opinions, perceptions, and impressions. Simple free being becomes encrusted with a burdensome armor of ego. Not until years later does an instinct come that a vital sense of mystery has been lost. The sun glints through the pines, and the heart is pierced in a moment of beauty and strange pain, like a memory of paradise. After that, we become seekers. Thanks for joining me today, seekers. I hope I see you again next week. And remember, the rest is still unwritten. So So for Rusty and the Conscious Communicator, I hope you have a fantastic week, and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Don.
We've come to the end of another hour here at the Conscious Communicator, and I can't thank you enough for joining me on this journey. Your phone calls and emails are greatly appreciated, and if you like what we're doing, please invite a friend to join us. This is a conversation that needs many voices, and as we open up the possibility of conscious communication to more and more people, the results will be a freeing of the true self from the burdensome armor of ego, and a flowering of the potential that is available to all of us. Until next time, peace out, travelers. The rest is still unwritten.